Good evening. A settlement in the OxyContin case against the Sackler family and their company, Purdue Pharma. Riding down to Biden's place with the yippies to deliver an appeal for new drug treatments and a gun buyback in the Bronx. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with some of the news for Wednesday, October 21st, 2020. Pope Francis became the first pontiff to endorse same-sex civil unions in comments for a documentary that premiered Wednesday. The pontiff's endorsement sparked cheers from gay Catholics and demands for clarification from conservatives. The pope said homosexual people have the right to be in a family. They are children of God. Francis said, "You can't kick someone out of a family nor make their life miserable for this. What we have to have is a civil union law. That's the way they are legally covered." Official Catholic teaching holds that gay people must be treated with dignity and respect, but that homosexual acts are intrinsically disordered. Recently, even some conservative Catholics have agreed that allowing civil unions is a good idea, even if it's not a church-sanctioned marriage. And this election year, even films are playing a role. Actor Sacha Baron Cohen is known for his mocking movies, tricking politicians and celebrities into embarrassing situations meant to take them down a peg or two. Cohen's latest mockumentary is a sequel to his hit Borat film, features former New York City mayor and Trump lawyer Rudy Giuliani in a compromising position in a hotel room with a young actress pretending to be a television journalist. The scene includes a moment when Giuliani is seen lying on a bed, tucking in his shirt with his hand down his pants, and the young woman nearby. Suddenly, Baron Cohen rushes in wearing an outlandish outfit, screaming the young woman is 15 years old. Baron Cohen has made a history of poking fun at conservative figures. For his 2018 Showtime series, Who is America?, the British comedian got former Vice President Dick Cheney to sign a waterboarding kit. That's a method used for torture in the Middle East by the United States forces there. In New York, United States District Judge Lewis Kaplan in Manhattan said he will consider, without hearing arguments, whether to excuse President Donald Trump from a defamation lawsuit by a former Elle magazine columnist. The decision comes after the coronavirus pandemic unexpectedly derailed the government from presenting its case on Wednesday. E. Jean Carroll, the former columnist, says Trump raped her in a Manhattan department store a quarter century ago and falsely denied it happened. At the behest of Attorney General William Barr, the Department of Justice wants to substitute the federal government for Trump as a defendant in Carroll's case. But a Justice Department lawyer says he has to be quarantined for 14 days, prompting the judge's decision to forego the oral arguments. And France's government presented its 2021 budget on Monday, a plan that aims to rescue the country's beleaguered economy from the impact of the pandemic by injecting a $49 billion stimulus next year. But in the United States, stocks closed lower on Wall Street today, extending the market's losses from a day earlier, as talks dragged on in Washington over its own economic stimulus package. President Donald Trump's call for another round of stimulus checks to most taxpayers is getting a lukewarm endorsement from his GOP allies on Capitol Hill, and Mitch McConnell has warned Trump about making any deals with Democrats before the election. Trump's chief of staff, Mark Meadows.
You know, obviously, Senate Republicans have had concerns with where the numbers are going, but it's not just the numbers. It's more the policy that the underlying policy that's not consistent with actually getting help to those Americans that need it most. And so whether it's a number issue or a policy issue, we continue to work. Secretary Mnuchin and Speaker Pelosi, I believe, are speaking right now. I spoke to him, a half hour, 45 minutes ago, and I'm still very hopeful and very optimistic that we're making progress. And yet, our Senate Republicans are starting to get to a point where they believe that she is not negotiating in a fair and equitable manner.
Do you see a vote on stimulus before you adjourn?
10, 15, none. Where do you think you stand?
I beg your pardon?
Senate Republicans, do you think you have handful, 10.
Listen, to have a vote count, I'm a good whip check. I can tell you that I've done that for a long time. It's really too early to tell until you have a bill. And so as we look at the bill, hopefully we'll get there. It looks like the Democrats have once again defeated at least a foundation of $500 to $600 billion. And in defeating that, it's a real disappointment, because at least we can agree upon both of the provisions that were put forth on the Senate floor today. way. And yet, because of politics, Democrats decided to just say no. But we're going to continue to stay engaged over the next couple of days. Thanks, guys.
Trump's chief of staff, Mark Meadows. On Thursday, the Senate Judiciary Committee is set to vote on the nomination of Judge Amy Coney Barrett as the newest Supreme Court justice. But Nancy Altman, the president of Social Security Works, says Barrett's nomination poses a threat to the national insurance program known as Social Security. That's been insuring Americans for lost paychecks since 1935, but faces new opposition from a conservative and young court.
As long as people are dependent on wages for their food and clothing and shelter and so forth, you need insurance against the loss of those wages. You can lose those wages if you become so disabled you could no longer work. You can lose those wages if you die leaving young children, or if you become very old and you, after a lifetime of work, you retire. You can also become unemployed, and unemployment insurance is not usually thought of as Social Security, but it was all part of the Social Security Act of 1935. We pay premiums. That's what FICA is, Federal Insurance Contributions Act, and those wages are then insured against loss in the event of death, disability, or old age.
How did it come to be? Brief.
For much of human history, and certainly much of U.S. history, people lived on farms. We are an agricultural country, so we didn't have the same dependence on wages. But as soon as we began to industrialize and urbanize, and we became dependent on wages. At that time, as people aged, your only choice was to move in with your adult children if you could no longer earn a living, or literally you went to the poorhouse. Every state but New Mexico, at the time Social Security was enacted, had poorhouses, mainly house older people who had been working independent during their lives but became so old, no longer earned money, and had no family that could take them in.
And what is the threat that it's facing, in your opinion, if Amy Coney Barrett is confirmed?
In 1935, when Social Security was enacted, it was almost a foregone conclusion that it was going to be held unconstitutional, because people who had originalist views, and that is that the federal government is very limited and this kind of broad-based insurance was not an appropriate or recognized role of the government. We then had decades and decades of law that recognized that the federal government did have power over Social Security and Medicare. But we have these radical new justices, and Judge Barrett is one of them. She's in line with the people in the 19th century, said, no, this shouldn't be the federal government. And when she was asked explicitly, she was asked in her hearings whether she thought Social Security and Medicare were constitutional. She did not answer. And that, of course, should send a chill down everyone's spine.
What are we facing right now?
We're facing a retirement income crisis. Social Security is a solution, so we should build on that. We should have term limits on the Supreme Court, and we should expand the number. There's nothing magical about the number nine. It's throughout the history of the court, the number has been higher and lower. I don't think Social Security is an immediate threat, but the longer this goes on with this kind of really radical Supreme Court, Franklin Roosevelt was trying to enact his New Deal legislation. Many of those proposals were found unconstitutional. We don't want to return to that. They're about to find the Affordable Care Act unconstitutional. This is not just hypothetical. If we want as a nation to have economic security, health security, we need these programs. The American people overwhelmingly agree, and we can't have an unelected Supreme Court take these protections from us.
Nancy Altman is the president of Social Security Works. And former Judge Bill Blum agrees Barrett's nomination is probably guaranteed, and that her views on originalism are a dire threat to victories in civil rights once thought to be permanent.
I don't think that there is any way to stop her confirmation at this point. There might be some way to slow it down if the Democrats decide that they will not work with the Republicans in the Senate on anything, if they deny unanimous consent to any measure that's important to the Republicans other than the Barrett nomination. That means that Senate business could only be conducted if all of their members show up and they are able to have their quorum. But short of something like that working, I don't see any way to stop it. Maybe there can be some way to delay it a few days, and that would be worth doing as well, because then Barrett wouldn't be on the court to handle any emergency petitions like the one from Pennsylvania for another few days. So I think that this deed is done, and the radical right has succeeded in its decades-long effort to take over and remake the courts, the federal courts in the United States.
What did we learn, if anything, about her views on the issues of the day from the confirmation hearings?
I don't think we learned specifically anything that we didn't already know, and she dodged most substantive questions which were designed to reveal how she would likely vote on hot-button issues like abortion and the Affordable Care Act and election challenges. But as I wrote in a piece that was just published yesterday by The Progressive, we did learn, or rather have confirmed, what people who follow her closely already knew, and that is that she's a rigid originalist and that she has very little regard for precedent of the United States Supreme Court. And if you put those two doctrines together, originalism and disregard of prejudice, you have an incendiary mix for overturning a lot of very important precedent decisions, like Roe v. Wade.
Does her Catholicism have anything to do with this? Her religiosity?
Well, I can't say whether Catholicism does or it doesn't, because I'm not a theologian. But if I were given the choice of either guessing that it does or it doesn't, I would say it probably does, because her approach to originalism is not just to use it as a tool of constitutional interpretation, but almost as a means of biblical exegesis. She approaches originalism almost like St. Thomas Aquinas. She believes that the original public meaning of the terms used in the Constitution, like freedom of the press or due process, have A, discoverable meanings as of the late 18th century, and that those meanings are the law. They're not just tools to help the court decide contemporary issues, along with other tools such as precedent and tradition, but they are the law itself. So she's extremely dogmatic, and I would compare her in terms of her views to Clarence Thomas. I think we're getting a female version of Clarence Thomas on the court. She's also very bright, and she's very young by judicial standards, not by ordinary standards. She's only 48 years old, which means that if she remains in good health, she'll probably be on the bench for another 30 years, maybe even more.
And that is Bill Blum, a former judge. His article, Unequal Justice, Confirmation Hearings Exposed Barrett as a Hardcore Right-Wing Activist, is at progressive.org. And the Justice Department announced on Wednesday that Purdue Pharma, the maker of OxyContin, has agreed to plead guilty to criminal charges and face penalties of roughly $8.3 billion. Federal prosecutors said the settlement did not preclude criminal charges against Purdue executives or individual members of the company's owners, the wealthy Sackler family. United States Deputy Attorney General Jeff Rosen.
The global settlement announced today involves the company pleading guilty to three felony counts for defrauding the United States and violating the anti-kickback statute from 2009 to 2017. In addition to the company having agreed to plead guilty to these three felony counts, the company has agreed to a $3.544 billion criminal fine and a $2 billion criminal forfeiture amount. Further, on top of those, to resolve its civil liability, Purdue Pharma has agreed to $2.8 billion in damages to the United States. Now, the company's in bankruptcy, so the corporate resolution is subject to the bankruptcy court's approval. If it's approved, this will be a corporate settlement in total of more than $8.3 billion. Additionally, members of the Sackler family have agreed to pay $225 million in a civil settlement that will provide civil releases only. It's also important to note that this resolution does not prohibit future criminal or civil penalties against Purdue Pharma's executives or employees.
It's unlikely the company will end up paying anything close to the $8 billion in the settlement deal. The company is in bankruptcy court, and the federal government will have to take its place in a long line of creditors. Activists who've been tracking the web of lawsuits targeting the manufacturers of OxyContin and other opioids say the decision seems politically motivated by the Trump administration. Trump has wanted a settlement as a feather in his cap before the election. The founder of the website Opioid Litigation Tracker is Christine Minhey.
The difference between companies like Purdue and Philip Morris are that Purdue actually produces a drug that is used for genuine medicinal purposes and not diverted into recreational or other harmful uses of it. So there are different incentives at play when it comes to how much to go after Purdue. They say that bankruptcy is new beheading here, and Purdue, like Marie Antoinette, there's tremendous desire to see them go down in flames. But there is also the countervailing incentive to keep them financially soluble so that they could actually produce the medicines that are used in doctors' offices and hospitals around the nation.
What do you think of this public benefit corporation idea?
Yeah, I think it's interesting that it's being talked about so much now, especially when this public benefit trust clause or this condition was introduced initially when Purdue went into bankruptcy over a year ago in September 2019. The fact that it's being discussed so much now, like we have much to do with the fact that you have 25 state attorneys general wrote a letter to the U.S. Attorney General William Barr opposing that particular clause of the Purdue settlement because it would, as I had mentioned, condition future payments from the trust on continued sales of OxyContin. They do have a viable point. That is a genuine criticism. We also need to look at the political incentives involved for Attorney General in this instance. There is a tremendous instinct with states and government officials at the state level to ensure that states retain spending power when it comes to every type of opioid settlement imaginable. So to urge against what is widely seen as a tepid response to Purdue's decades at this point of harm, it's a valuable political tool on the part of state AGs trumping up their "we are the voice for the voiceless" paradigm when it's not necessarily the case. I think that municipalities deserve to get a tremendous amount of the funds directly.
The last thing I wanted to ask you about was these alternatives, putting the money, they said, and it seemed to be in passing, but were they really serious, in your opinion, of putting money into alternative drugs to opiates? I mean, drugs that could be used to cure people or revive them, and like naloxone and things like that.
We see these offers, settlement offers from different companies like Teva. Half of their the value of their settlement offers made up in the value of life-saving drugs. The use of OxyContin has ravaged communities for decades, for years and years and years now. So to pay out the cost of abatement by continued sales of a life-saving drug like naloxone is a little bit like poisoning a well and then charging a hefty ransom for the cure. It's a very perverse thing. You can cause a problem and then also sell the solution, and they're making a killing.
Christine Minhey is founder of the website Opioid Litigation Tracker. New York State Attorney General Letitia James signed on with other states to oppose the idea of a public benefit corporation to continue making OxyContin using the profits to pay for the settlement. James said in a statement, "Today's deal doesn't account for the hundreds of thousands of deaths or millions of addictions caused by Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family. Instead, it allows billionaires to keep their billions without accounting for how much they really made." Part of the deal announced by the Department of Justice would apparently provide funding for treatments for addiction. Naloxone, used to revive patients who've overdosed, is widely available, as is the drug known as Suboxone. Another drug is called Ibogaine. While Joe Biden was campaigning in North Carolina last Sunday, a group of drug reform activists from New York City were in the leafy suburb of Greenville, Delaware, deliver a message to the presidential candidate at his home and church. led by longtime activist Dana Beale, the group first negotiated with the Secret Service agent at the Joseph on the Brandywine Roman Catholic Church, where Joe Biden often hears Mass with his MD wife, Jill.
Well, I wish you luck, sir. Enjoy the
match. We weren't really sure that he was going to win until now. But we're basically going to be respectfully standing around with our signs demonstrated for the next 4 years. So they should get used to it.
Okay. All right. Y'all have a good day. Enjoy your stay.
Thank you.
The drug crisis has impacted the election in unexpected ways. Social media sites have been working overtime to silence a New York Post article that perp walked Joe Biden's son Hunter's drug use in a so far unsuccessful October surprise to reawaken Trump's flailing campaign. But Joe already had confronted his son's addiction during the first 2020 presidential debate, saying, "My son, like a lot of people at home, had a drug problem. He fixed it. He worked on it, and I'm proud of him. I'm proud of my son." In a New Yorker article, it was revealed that Hunter Biden went to a clinic in Tijuana, Mexico in 2014 that provided a treatment using Ibogaine. According to the article, after receiving the psychoactive alkaloid derived from the roots of a West African shrub, Hunter Biden drove to Flagstaff, Arizona, where he practiced Vedic meditation and where Hunter was advised to meditate twice a day to help keep his cravings for alcohol at bay. Beale says that even as tranquil a spot as the Biden's home and church should not silence the truth about Hunter's use of Ibogaine to beat his demons. So he went to Greenville to deliver the good news about the drug directly to Joe Biden's mailbox.
Joe Biden's mailbox. So I'm writing Joe and Joe Biden on this. I need something to write on, so I'm going to use my sign. Okay, let's see if I can open this up. Yep. There, you saw it. We delivered it. You got proof we delivered it. I gave him two flyers in his mailbox. Why are we here? Because we want them to replace no-knock narcs with EMTs with a social worker degree, with Ibogaine. Ibogaine is a drug from Africa that Hunter Biden took to get off of cocaine. And shouldn't it be available to everyone?
Afterwards, Beale left a message for the media.
We're here today calling on Biden to turn over a new leaf and not just be for decrim, because decrim is not enough. We had decrim under Rudy Giuliani. It was called stop and frisk. So even a little bit of marijuana prohibition applied to many, many people completely uses up the bandwidth of the system. And they have no law enforcement capability left over for anything else. Now, we don't even believe law enforcement should be used to address the drug problem. It's a medical problem. But there are real law enforcement problems in this country. The Nazis are running wild. And we're calling on Joe Biden to remember, I guess when he was a kid, that World War II had just happened and they were supposed to have gotten rid of the Nazis. Guess what? The Nazis are back, as big as life and twice as natural. So it's time to focus on getting rid of the Nazis, which Biden promised he will do, and medicalize the drug problem. I will also note for the cameras that Hunter Biden is a beneficiary of an Ibogaine treatment in Mexico. Wouldn't it be nice if that Ibogaine came back from Mexico and was available to people in this country who have a coke problem or a heroin problem or a meth problem? Biden is going to have to deal with this issue, and he should come to the table and talk to us. We have a lot of suggestions and advice that we want to give him.
Activist Dana Beale. He He's yet to get a reply from the Bidens. And finally, for people living with disabilities, casting even a mail-in vote may represent or present a whole new set of obstacles. Andrea Sears has this report.
People living with disabilities have often faced physical obstacles to casting their votes, but their advocates say voting by mail can present a different set of challenges. In every election, people with disabilities have encountered polling places that lack wheelchair ramps or other accommodations. But now, with the COVID pandemic making in-person voting riskier for those with underlying health conditions, Monica Bartley with the Center for Independence of the Disabled New York points out that people who are blind or have problems with dexterity can't fill out a standard mail-in ballot.
We had a lawsuit just before the primary election, and that enabled us to get an accessible absentee ballot.
Applications for the online accessible ballots can be found at elections.ny.gov. The application must be received at least 7 days before the election. But using the accessible ballot can mean a whole new set of obstacles. Once filled out, the ballot must be printed out on legal-sized paper. And Bartley points out that not everyone has access to a printer or one that can handle that size of paper.
So we're giving people options of saving the ballot on a thumb drive and going to the library or some public place that offers that service to print their ballot.
She adds polling places are supposed to have ballot marking devices to allow people who can't fill out a ballot manually to cast their vote in person. Bartley says for people with disabilities, issues like keeping the Affordable Care Act's guarantee of health insurance for anyone with pre-existing conditions could make this vote a matter of life or death.
We want to make sure that we are also involved in this process, choosing what we think would be better for our lives.
For New York News Connection, I'm Andrea Sears.
And thank you, Andrea, for that. And that's some of the news for Wednesday, October 21st, 2020. The news is produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson from New York City. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for listening.